You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. And what a delight and an honor. And I couldn't have imagined it would happen. But today I have the great privilege of speaking with Francis Moore LePay. Now, people of numerous vintages will recognize that name. Some will not, but Francis Moore LePay is, let me just tell you, she's a prominent researcher, author, advocate of democracy, and prolific writer. She's written, I think, 20 books by the last count, and is likely working on another as we speak. She is probably best known for a book that came out in 1971 originally, since has been republished numerous times. It called Diet for a Small Planet, and it changed the world in all sorts of ways. So much so, I think it was Michael Pollan who now is the food expert in the world, but he refers to her sometimes as the godmother of the plant-based living revolution that is still evolving. And so, Francis, thank you so much for being willing to take some time and have a conversation about then, about now, and about maybe the future. So
my great pleasure, David. We can see the smile on my face. It reflects my inner feelings.
Good. Well, so let's just dive right in, and I can be economical with your time. But so you wrote Diet for a Small Planet, not to be confused by the book that came out later, Diet for a New America, by John Robbins, but Diet for a Small Planet, which really opened up a conversation that is still, at least in my mind, relevant. And would you be willing to just say a little bit, just, you know, what's, if there is a main argument to be made from that book, is it, what were you trying to do? What were you trying to do in that original book?
Well, I was just sharing with the world my wonderment at the realization that the dominant frame at that time in 1971 had been set by a professor at Stanford who said, we were running out of food. The book was called Population Bomb.
Yes.
And so I thought, oh, wow, that's a great question. Is it really true that we're overrunning the Earth's capacity to feed us? I want to find that out. And so I went to the library. And I put the numbers together, and guess what I found? I found that this great professor was wrong, that there's more than enough for all of us to eat well, and that we were actually taking the Earth's abundance and funneling so much into livestock production that returned to us a small fraction of what is possible, that we were shrinking the Earth's food supply. But even with that shrinking, there was still enough. But it was just crazy to me. It was just, I wanted to tell the world, wait a minute. No. It's not about lack of food, it's lack of power for people to have the income and wherewithal to purchase the food that is best for us and the planet and what they need. Hunger is not about scarcity of food. It's about scarcity of power and therefore scarcity of democracy. And in some way, you know, my whole journey has been that journey to what is democracy. And that's really still my mission here that I founded a couple of decades ago, Small Planet Institute.
Yeah. You know, that is a leap No, I take that back. That is a linkage that I think still puzzles people, right? You say, I mean, perhaps the link between food, diet, and democracy, and in some ways production, how it's produced. So
absolutely,
so could you help create that linkage for people? Why is, or how is, food and how it's grown, or what is grown, or the purpose of what's grown? How is that related to power and democracy?
Well, first we have to understand democracy. We think of it as a political system, but who runs who controls the political system? Fundamentally, in our system, we allow private wealth so much power, so much influence, and lobbyists. You know, first of all, we don't have public funding of campaigns, and so candidates have to rely on private money, and we also allow so much lobbying. There are, I think, 24 lobbyists in Washington for every person that we elect to represent us, and a lot of those are meat industry lobbyists. So we have to understand that we talk about democracy. We talk about, I'm referring to the failure, the brokenness of ours that has allowed private interest to so determine how we use our land and what we're able to purchase and how much it is and how healthy it is, all of that. It's all connected. Start thinking about our economy and our democracy as an ecosystem and not thinking of it as separate mm-hmm. entities.
Mm-hmm. When you first wrote the book, did you get a lot of pushback about the claim, not the claim about resources, but the claim about democracy? And the use of land resources to essentially raise animals, which, you know, is sort of way less efficient than using the land to produce the fruits and vegetables, et cetera, that people can eat. Did you get a lot of pushback from that?
Well, I certainly got pushback from the meat lobby.
Oh, I'll bet that's right.
They were not happy. They were not happy. But I from the very beginning, I also got a lot of support of people being so excited about the opening of the doors to all these different. It's you know, what I like to think about this awakening that I went through, it wasn't I can't eat that. It's, I can eat this whole world, because where is the diversity of flavors? And if you think of the world's cuisines that are so interesting in Asia or Africa, you know, that they are plant-based and combination of all the different, the legumes of peas, beans, and lentils and all the different curries in the world. That's where the fun starts. I grew up in Texas, which is pretty funny. I could smell the stockyards almost from my home. And it was, everything was, you know, you had dinner. What was dinner? It was meat. It was starch, and it was some kind of veggie.
Right.
And so that's so limited. And yeah. And so what was so exciting is I realized that we could get a healthier diet from all these different peas, beans, and lentils, that, you know, and all the range of vegetables, and that we didn't need as much protein as the mythology was telling us at all. It was just, rather than being limiting, it was just freeing. And I at that time there was this limiting frame that's now been discarded, but that you needed to balance. It was called protein, you know, balancing, right. Complementary proteins. You had to have so much of this and so much of that. Right. But even that, I loved that. I used to say, hey, I feel like a chemist in the kitchen, that I can put it all together. And, you know, 10, 20 so years ago, or I don't know when that was debunked, but it said, look, don't worry about any of that. If you eat a healthy diet and you eat a whole range of things, including in, you know, in the plant world, of course, what has the most protein are peas, beans, lentils, and nuts. But since we don't need as much as we thought we did anyway, we just don't have to worry about our protein intake. Right. And that And the other thing I want to add that's so exciting in recent years, that actually I've seen studies showing that plant-centered diet is associated with greater longevity, that it, rather than limiting one's life, it actually is healthier and lengthens one life.
Right.
Yeah, that, you know, I think a bunch of people have been, maybe a little bit before your book, but have been talking about the, you know, the benefits of the amount of animal protein a person consumes. In fact, I remember trying to do it, not always successfully, when I first read the book, and, you know, combining the various grains, et cetera, to get complete protein.
Right. That was it. It became, wait a minute, it's so much easier. So it's great. And so in the later editions, I've made it clearer that it's even easier than I thought.
Do you think the conversation is the same now? That conversation about food and democracy, is it a linkage that is still important to underline? Or do you think people are aware of that?
No. I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I think, at least in the circles I bump into, it still surprises people. You know, some people have adopted, probably many people have adopted plant-based eating for health reasons, which, fine, great, wonderful. But I don't know if they make the same, if they dive deeper, because I think, as I recall, it's been a while since I read the book. I read the 50th edition, and, you know, and which was, congratulations.
It's a book. Thank you. It's still, 50 years, wow.
Well, unbelievable, really. When you think about that, it's quite amazing. But the way food is produced, the large industrial machine that produces our food, where... there's almost a belief that in order to produce the amount of food that human beings need, it can't be done in smaller, more sustainable ways. It has to be large agribusiness, you know, a bunch of different fertilizers to increase yield. It's still, that mythology is still around.
And we have to keep underscoring that what we have now, it's what is reduces the capacity of the earth to feed us, because we're such a huge portion of our agricultural land. 80%, something like, of all of our agricultural land produces going into meat production that gives us 18% of our calories. I mean, that's where we're wasting. That's where so it's the opposite of the mythology.
Right.
That there is more than enough for all, and it's healthier. But the mythology still hangs on. It's interesting, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, one goes to a restaurant now, at least here in the Boston area, there's typically some kind of plant option, and yet the mythology still is out there. Yeah.
I think it's clear that there's more vegetarian, vegan eating than there used to be. I remember back in the early 70s, you know, going into a restaurant, the waiter is suggesting something, and I would say something like, well, I'm a vegan or a vegetarian, and they would say, wait, what? What, you want fish with that? You know,
that's right. I get that. It's so intense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not giving up.
No, exactly.
Because
no.
There's more and more evidence of how healthy this is for us and the planet. And it's just, we've got to do it, because there's so much, not just greenhouse gas emissions emitted, which is, of course, is huge. By the way, methane, which comes out of the tail, of cattle, is one of the most intense greenhouse harmer gases. And but also the destruction of biodiversity, as we're just growing more and more, you know, corn or soybeans to feed to livestock. So it's for every part of the, and the destruction of the Amazon. People don't recognize that we're destroying rainforests in order to produce meat.
It's quite something that you know, I'm patting you on the back from afar.
Oh, good. Thank you.
But it is quite something that it's since the original publication of that book, and again, let's talk about some of the other ones, but since the original publication of that book, so many of the conversations, the enormous conversations that have grown out of increasing research, science, having little to do with food itself, right? I mean, the destruction of the environment, et cetera, has demonstrated how prescient your insights were. So, you know, it was not just the amount of land or the amount of grains that were being produced simply to feed cattle, right? It's all those other things that you just mentioned that really weren't part of the national and now worldwide conversations back then. And it sort of revealed that how we produce our food, what we produce and how we produce our food is still such an important issue, such an important thing. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder,
David, can I, before we move on from the very first book, I just wanted to all who are with us today, I often say to young people, but any of us, you know, find your question. If you are lost, you know, find your question. And so the thing I want to underscore is that, you know, the importance of just finding the most essential question that you have and then asking the next question and the next question. And no matter how deficient you feel, I often tell people, I share the fact that I made a C on my first English paper in college, right? And so I've written all these books since. So if you're in college and you're not doing that well, don't be discouraged. Or, you know, if you've never written anything, if you've never written a blog, or, you know, just if you have the messages, if you have something that you believe is important for people to hear, you will figure out how to share it and get feedback from friends and relatives. And so I just love to tell people that I did not start out as an accomplished writer.
I think that's such an important message. And it's, you know, the history of your work is one that sort of underscores how that unfolds, right? I mean, here was this Stanford professor, Paul Ehrlich, I guess it was, who wrote the population bomb, right? I mean, Stanford professor, an economist, right? It's like it's a big deal. And it came out with this, which everybody was, you know, I mean, it was quite the buzz, right? It was
big.
And suddenly here's this young woman with, I don't know, I don't even know if you had a graduate degree at the time.
No, I did not. No.
Yeah.
No.
That, you know, was like, well, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. I mean, it's such a nervy and fabulous thing. And look what it's revealed, and look what has become of it, which is, and I think it's still becoming that, right? I mean, there is more and more evidence for the value, not just to the organism, the human organism, but to the planet. You know, forget, and I mean, I think it actually, you know, it gave fire to the whole animal rights movement.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. I mean, just the way the farm animals are treated. And
I know.
So this, you know, this young woman, practically a girl, this young woman with this, you know, with this idea is just really, it's an enormous accomplishment. And so thanks for saying that.
I also want to mention another point that I'm so pleased. I should say, I would have said proud, but I shouldn't be proud because she needs all the credit. But my second child, Anna LePay, and by the way, I named my daughter Anna, and then later found out that in Hindi it means food. And so Anna LaPay, please go to the Global Alliance for the Future of Food. That's a great website, Global Alliance for the Future of Food, that Anna now leads. And so, you know, she and I worked together on the 50th anniversary edition of Diet for Small Planet. And we also worked together to write a book called Hope's Edge. And I highly recommend our book because Anna and I traveled the world. And if you want hope right now in this dark time, we profile through story the most progressive and encouraging and courageous social movements in the world that are pushing forward the edge of hope is the way we think about it. And a lot of it has to do with ecological agriculture. I just highly recommend Global Alliance for the Future of Food.
Thank you. And I'll make sure that gets up on the screen when we put out the final thing. And you've sort of anticipated where I wanted to go, which was, you know, your sense of hope. But, you know, where does that come from? And I think in addition to that, what you just said, that piece about how people raise food and those movements all around the world, there is a reclaiming of power, because right now we are, most of us, unless you're a farmer, unless you're growing your own food, we are subject to the interests that bring us our food. And to be at least somewhat more free of that, right, it's a reclaiming of right now. I mean, you know, cut off food supplies and the world changes dramatically really fast.
Right. Right. And absolutely. And it's so concentrated now.
It's more and more so, right? And more and more.
Yeah.
Those interests are larger and larger. In some ways, the conversation, it's very much the same conversation that you were having then, but on steroids.
Right.
Because
right.
The concentration is enormous now, the concentration of food producers. But you do have this. And you sense it through, one does sense it through so many of the books that you've written. And I would be lying if I told you I read and remember all of them, but I don't. But you do have this, there is this strand of hope for the possibility of the future. And I am wondering where that comes from. And I guess I want you to talk about that in a way that communicates the reason, because, you know, there's so many reasons to feel doom and gloom at the moment, perhaps more so now with the behavior of the current administration. But yet there, you seem to have this reason to hope. And so I'm hoping you'll speak about that for people, especially young people who are listening to this.
Well, first of all, hope is not wishful thinking. Hope, I want to make that clear. It's not wishing for something.
Right.
And that hope, if we aren't changing ourselves, if we aren't taking risks, then how can we believe that others can? So hope requires courage. Mm-hmm. And courage is rooted in the French and the Latin, a cur, heart, that when that pounding heart, I love to say, when you're scared and your heart is pounding, reinterpret it as your inner applause telling you to go for it. Because this is, you know, we often think, oh, if I'm nervous about something, that means that I'm on the wrong track. It may mean, it probably does, that you are maybe, if you're doing something for what you believe in, it means that, of course, your heart's going to pound a little bit. Of course, you're going to be a bit insecure. And that, go for it, girl. Go for it, guy. You know, that is the spirit that I've tried to incorporate into my own life and to share with others that my assumption about human beings is that we have very deep needs beneath the physical. And they are our need for a sense of power, that an agency that we count, a sense of meaning, that what we do matters, and that we are connected to others. And so we have to drop this mythology that's so damaging, that human beings are just selfish little shoppers. No.
Right. Right.
We people give their lives in order to meet these deeper needs for power, meaning, and connection. And so I'm just encourage each of us to think about, what is it in our lives that can meet those deep needs? And what do I need, you know, in terms of friendships and support to take the risks? Because we have to take risks, but it's very hard to do that alone. So do you have one friend? Do you have one family member who you can say, okay, let's try something different. Let's try to, you know, if it makes our heart pound, that's okay. And because that's where we are. We have to do what we thought we could not do. And so I try to live that. I don't want to pretend to say that I'm always able to, but that's what we're trying to do here at the Small Planet Institute.
Now, let me ask you, when you were writing the book, did it feel like you were doing it alone? Or did you, like, what did you lean on to give you the courage to, oh, okay, I'm going to go after this Stanford, I'm going to dare to say, he's wrong. Where'd that
come
from?
Well, I was terrified in the beginning, you know, honestly, as I said, I thought, oh my gosh, what if I got all the numbers wrong? You know, that was when I was using my dad's slide rule. Many of you won't know what a slide rule is. It was long before computers and digital instruments. So I was a little bit terrified, or more than a little bit, but I was also, and here again, I think if we take risks, I believe it because we're all connected, that doors open. So because I was willing to take that risk, this kid out of college, just asking the burning question and going for it, I started out with just a few page handout, and through a friend, guess what? It got into the hands of the founder of paperback publishing in America, Betty Ballantyne. And she came to my door and she said, Frances, you know, I want to turn this into a book, and whoever publishes it, I'll buy it. And that was Betty Ballantyne.
Wow.
And she died quite a number of years ago, but I did get to go and personally thank her. And it was just such a great joy. But the point is that I really do believe that. And I think because all is connected, that if we take those risks, then we are sending out signals, and that connections get made and the next door will open. So I often say, just find one buddy, because we are social creatures. So it's very hard to do things absolutely alone, but talk to your friends, and who else is feeling uncomfortable about not doing enough, you know, or not take, and just find one, or a small group, or, you know, now with the internet, it's so easy to find your local groups to join, and then ask the next question, you know, what can we do that's more courageous, and let one thing lead to the next, and keep asking the next question. I guess that's my big advice, is, and the question behind the question, and trust that hope. I'm working here, our organization of people here in my office today are working with me on a new book called Hidden Hope, because we think that hope is so critical. And so we're taking a number of social issues, including the food, but where in the world are the breakthroughs happening? And then telling the stories of, like, what country is number one in health, and how do we learn from that? Because we're way, way down below our peer countries and the health of our people, and that, you know, our diet has a lot to do with it. So, you know, just, this is a big project. And I have to learn, we all have to write this. We have to learn about a lot of different topics, but I do believe that hope is power.
Yeah. Say the title of the book again. And
hidden,
I know.
Hidden Hope.
It's Hidden Hope.
Hope.
Work in progress.
It's in progress.
Right. And so let's just, because I know we spoke about this briefly last time. So this is finding reasons to hope. by looking at actually what is going on elsewhere in the world.
Yes. It's very clear structure. We take health, education, the environment, democracy, and we say, okay, where does the U.S. rank? And you just go, oh my God, I thought it was bad, but are we really down, way, way down below our peers? And the answer is yes. We just sank in democracy. We're now 57th, I believe, in the world in democracy, whereas our peers are up in the top 20 mainly. So we say, oh my gosh. And then we have a shorter section on why is it that we rank so low? It's the hard facts. And then we go to which is the leading country, or in some cases, the leading two countries where there are two very different cultures that have both been ranked very high. For example, in health, and a lot of it has to do with diet, two countries have been ranked as the superior in health, and they are Spain and Japan. And the healthy diet is key in both, as well as exercise. But I'd love that one of the stories about Japan that we could do anywhere, and we could do certainly here, is that children in grade school learn to cook.
Oh, wow.
That's part of growing up. And so you're not just buying chips, you know, potato chips at the cafeteria. You're actually cooking and sharing what you cook with your fellow students. And so you get used to thinking, oh yeah, it's a meal, it's something we cook at home, not that we go out to McDonald's, you know?
That book's gonna need a section on humility. Because I think one of the things that is so powerful in the United States is that, you know, it's hard for Americans to be humble. Right? America's the best country.
Oh, that's the biggest obstacle.
And that is an obstacle where there really
that
is space to hear.
Deadly.
No space to hear that, no, actually, you know what? They've got a better idea over there. They're doing that.
And yeah.
So.
No, that's one of our biggest handicaps is the mythology, although that is somewhat declining. But rather than motivating people, I think it's more, unfortunately, it's just more kind of humiliation and discouragement rather than saying, oh, you know, what can we learn from others? And that's really the liberation about this era when we're somewhat shocked by what's happening. If we can liberate ourselves to look to guidance from other countries and how they've gotten money out of politics, for example, and how they've gotten a healthier food system.
And well, I'm going to ask you an unfair question, which you don't have to answer. But here's the unfair question: we know what our world is like today. At least our world here in the United States, right? Enormous division. And so, what's needed to get from this current state of things to a world that is more? Well, maybe I don't want to feed that. Maybe I don't want to skew the question. What would be better? Obviously, less division, people working together, more collaboration. How do we get there?
It all comes down to democracy. What is democracy? It's where the people's voice is determining outcomes, and the people's voice that is developed through learning and talking with one another. That is democracy, and it's not what we have today. We have, as I've stressed, so much private interest and so much disinformation through corporate-controlled media, particularly Fox News, where people are just filled with disinformation. So even in my own family, I have people who voted for Donald Trump because they believe what the disinformation that's being put out. We do have a report here. You can go to our website, Small Planet Institute website, and you can just download it. It's called Crisis of Trust, and it's about the crisis of disinformation and highlights how other countries are stepping up to try to help people sort through with bipartisan information screening, you know, not censorship, but to really alert people to what is disinformation. And it's really helped. Australia is an example of it, New Zealand. But So that is a big part of the problem, that we are getting different information. Mm-hmm. And we can't have democracy unless we have one conversation and a shared set of one of the facts that we're debating. If we're debating different truths, and you know, we have different truths, then we're in big trouble. And so I think that is a key part of our work, is to really work for identifying the power of disinformation. Mm-hmm. And in all, you know, and when we speak to friends and neighbors who disagree with us, you know, without attacking them, to say, "Oh, where did you learn that? And would you be willing to look at this other source and consider it?" And not say, "Oh, you idiot for watching that false stuff." But let's look at both and see, why don't we look at both of them? And where did that information come from? And where did this information come from? Mm-hmm. And be in conversation, not in a battle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that right there is a good place to at least pause this conversation. Unless there is something else that you want to make sure you put out there. Thank you so much for being willing to speak about this. I think those many messages that were embedded in that book years back are still alive and well. And I would encourage people not just to read Diet for a Small Planet if they have not, but some of the other work that you have done over. The book that you wrote with your daughter, again, is
Hope's Edge.
Hope's Edge. Hope's Edge.
Okay. Yeah. And this theme of hope is not for wimps, right? Hope is for people, that we all need hope. We know that. We know human beings have to have hope, but mm-hmm. we only do that as we push our edge, you know, and take risks. And I just encourage all of us. I'm speaking to myself. I don't mean to be at all bragging, because I struggle as well with taking risks.
Absolutely.
But to find just one friend, it can just start with one friend. Maybe it's your spouse. Maybe it's your, you know, just a buddy, or maybe it's a stranger. But find one friend who can take a risk with us, because often, you know, we're such social creatures that we often need one other person and then go from there. Maybe it's somebody in your church, or you never know. But we have to be comfortable with the pounding heart of our nervousness believe that we can go for it. That inner applause.
I love that. I love that idea, that the pounding heart that we so easily just say is fear is actually applause. Yes, yeah. It wouldn't be pounding if this wasn't worthwhile. So
Exactly.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Frances Moore LePay, thank you so much for being willing to speak.
Oh, and my great pleasure.
So I'm going to count you as one of those new friends of mine. So
thank you. Likewise. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, especially when your book comes out. So
yeah, I'd love to. Love to.
Fabulous.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.